I think for many people, you know, Chinese medicine is something because of the depth of it. It changes who you are. You know, you look at life in a different way. You bring in holism and, depending again, the direction you want to take it. I mean, for me also, it involves meditation as part of that also. So it involves, self-growth and self-awareness and things that make you a better person, I think.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Geological, the podcast that curates East Asian medicine and methods through the power of conversation. There are moments in clinic when it's frustrating working with people. From the inability for some folks to articulate their problem, to the search for shortcuts, protocols, and easy answers read about on the internet, maybe they're just looking for some exotic magic. At times, it's maddening. And what's more, I do it too. I have to guard against it all the time. I hope that I can be a helpful influence in someone's life. It's taken time and practice just to smile inwardly when a patient says, "I'm better because of something that my massage therapist told me to do." At this point, on a good day, I don't care. I'm there to help, not to win applause. Clinic, it's challenging. There are patients whose problems I don't understand. Like an iceberg, I can see what's above the surface, but I don't know what lies beneath. And I think I should too, with the Chinese medicine skills, perspectives, and diagnostic tools, I should be able to glimpse the mechanism, should be able to grasp the process that has led them to walk through my door. Sometimes it seems clear, only to get a ways into treatment and realize that I've left out important findings that I previously didn't see. I thought I understood, but didn't. With others, I'm clear that I'm not clear, and I hate that because I think I should be. If I was just better at reading the pulse or palpating the channels, or if I could listen better into the spaces that they're not attending to. But there is only so much time to connect, assess the situation, and conjure up a diagnosis that ticks the boxes of their complaint, the underlying pathomechanism that makes sense to me, and that part which is not rational, that goes by feel, that trusts where my hands are drawn. There is that part of me that likes the feeling of certainty, that likes to feel competent, and beyond that, skilled and capable. But so often, patients are a mystery. We can hypothesize an understanding, but it takes the testing through treatment to discern where we're seeing clearly and where we need to try again. It feels good to know that sense of solidity and knowing. I do my best to enjoy that when I can, because often enough, it's not that I'm working in the dark, but more like working in shadow. Some comfort with discomfort, a capacity to tolerate uncertainty, that certainly is helpful. Speaking of uncertainty, how about studying acupuncture at a time when there were no schools, precious few books, no licensure, and if someone had heard about it, it was this strange exotic thing from a culture that we had little connection with. There was, after all, that bamboo curtain thing back then. And anyway, how are a few needles supposed to bring healing? It was not so easy in the beginning. But for the hardy souls like Stuart Watts, that challenge was more of an invitation than obstruction. A lot of the early practitioners felt like this. They were certainly cut from a different cloth than I was when I first started to consider the study of acupuncture. I suspect it does help when you're younger and unencumbered with things like mortgages, children, and other people's opinions of what you're up to. One thing for sure, Stuart had a taste for pushing the edges. There are some great stories in this conversation. Stories that remind me of the spirit of what it means to set your sights on something that you don't yet know how to achieve. And to follow your heart and getting there. We'll get into all of this in a moment. Stay with us. These conversations come to you through the generous support of our sponsors and members. All the sponsors here provide helpful products or services that you'll find beneficial in your clinical work. Worried that an EMR is too complex for you? Jane has friendly and knowledgeable support. Mayway Herbs is celebrating the 55th year of their family business. You're invited to make use of their vast library of resources. Are you concerned about the health of Mother Earth? AccuFast Needles is doing something about that. You can too. And later in the show, Ancestral Sturman offers up a sinew treatment, and the folks at Blue Poppy have something special to share as well. Do be sure to visit the sponsors page on the Geological website to take advantage of all the special offers our terrific sponsors have for listeners of the podcast.
Hi folks, I'm Yvonne Lau, president of Mayway Herbs. Our family business turns 55 this year, and we wouldn't have gotten this far without the love and support of our community. We're truly grateful and promise you that we'll continue to work hard to support you and your practice. Please visit Mayway.com to find the perfect Pumsar brand formula or formulate your own in our dispensary. Our site also has lots of articles, videos, and herbal recipes for you to explore. And tune into our podcast, Chinese Medicine Matters, for insightful discussions on all things TCM. Learn about treatment strategies and powerful herbal remedies. As we welcome the month of May, our focus is on women's health. Our newsletter articles and podcast episodes this month will highlight different aspects and unique challenges women face. So subscribe or tune in. And if you're a practitioner, get a discount on our women's health formulas this month. Just visit Mayway.com. This season and every season, trust Mayway Herbs for your health and wellness needs. And thank you for supporting Real Chinese Medicine.
I love how technology can help to automate my office, and I want to share with you my favorite tool for doing so, Jane. Jane is a clinic management software in EMR with a human touch. Whether you're switching your software or going paperless for the first time, the Jane team knows that the onboarding process can feel a little overwhelming. That's why with Jane, you don't just get software, you get a whole team. Included in every Jane subscription is their award-winning customer support available by phone, email, and chat whenever you need it, even Saturdays. You can also book a free account setup consultation to review your account and ensure you feel confident about going live. If you're interested in making the switch to Jane, head to jane.app/switch to book a one-on-one demo with a member of their support team. And be sure to mention the code CHEOLOGICAL at the time of sign up for a 1 month grace period on your new Jane account. I don't know about you, but sometimes I take a step back and marvel at my acupuncture needles. I mean, they're the world's simplest medical tool, a sharpened wire and a handle. That's it. And with this simple tool, hundreds of health conditions can be resolved. I love it. What I didn't love was the amount of packaging waste I generated at the end of the day. But that has now changed too. Ever since I switched to AccuFast Earth-Friendly Needles, I reduced my packaging waste by 90%. Not only are they a great needle, but the folks at AccuFast plant a tree for every two boxes of needles I use in the clinic. By switching to AccuFast Needles, you'll be helping patients, planting trees, and joining a community of practitioners changing the world. Like our simple needle, being a part of the solution, it's simple too. Visit AccuFastNeedles.com/geological to learn how. Stuart Watts, welcome to Geological.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you. You are one of these people that was involved in our profession before there really was a dang profession.
It's true. It's true. Back in 68 to 72, really. I mean, that's back in California and just my early starts, you know, seeing people that are, some of them now long gone, some of them still here, actually. You know, Dr. Christopher, the herbalist, and Bernard Jensen, the naturopath, and Michael Tierra, who I hope is still around. He was one of my early teachers, and in Santa Cruz. I used to live in Santa Cruz from, I think, 66 to about 72, 74, actually. So I try to learn from who was there then, and I would go to workshops at various places, both in San Francisco. San Francisco, you just knock on doors and see who would show you whatever. And sometimes, you know, I'd go down to L.A. and study with Pedro Chan, if you've ever heard that name. Pedro Chan was a Chinese who was open enough to actually have classes in acupuncture publicly.
And what year was this?
That would have been, I think, 71, 72, something like that.
71, 72. You were in really early. I'm curious, man, the 60s and 70s, what a moment in American history. I'm wondering when it was, Stuart, that you first started to cotton to acupuncture. Like what was going on around you? What were the headlines? What were the issues of the day? How did acupuncture sort of come into your mind and land as, oh, there might be something here?
You know, it was probably more around, you know, holistic medicine. And there was all these workshops around California and I don't remember the name of the association, but down in San Diego. And they used to have these workshops that I'd go to on basically, you know, nutrition and health. And those were what really interested me. And then kind of meeting, actually, I met a man named Esteban, who actually became the vice president of Bastyr, I believe. He was an acupuncturist, just kind of wandering around between Mexico and Seattle. And, you know, he came and I had a group of, I used to teach yoga and Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, and he came and did some classes there. And that excited me about that. But I think probably Pedro Chan was the earliest classes.
Esteban, hang on a second. There was a cat. I don't remember his first name. His last name was Esteban. He was this naturopath kind of character, and he had a little office at the Pike Place Market.
That's it.
That's him.
Yeah. That's his first name, is Esteban, Steve. His last name is Ramaki.
I remember that guy. We used to go there. I used to work at the Pike Place Market in the late, I'm not kidding, man, late 70s, early 80s, and he had... When we thought we'd be getting sick, he had this little box of, you know, gelatin caps with some kind of herbs. We had no idea what was in there.
Yeah.
But we knew that the damn stuff was helpful.
Yeah, I knew him before that, before he moved to Pikes. And, you know, I went to visit him at least once that I know of. And it was so much fun because he'd walk down through Pike Market and everybody would be throwing him fish or some oranges or something. Because he got, you know, he used to go there really early in the morning and treat really early all the vendors. So
I was one of them.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, I'd go in to get the herbs. I didn't get treated for other stuff. And I had no idea that he also did acupuncture. I always thought of him as this kind of weird market herbalist cat.
Yeah, no, he was an early acupuncturist. I mean, you know, it was limited. I mean, in those days, you know, acupuncture training had two books, you know. One of them was Pedro Chan's kind of ripping off the outline of Chinese acupuncture and putting his name on as the author. And the other one was Felix Mann, How It Works Scientifically. And then soon after that came Mary Austin's book on Five Elements, which was really written by Lawson Woods. I met Lawson Woods when I was in England studying, and he showed me the original book that he gave to Mary Austin to take to America to get it published, because he was a minister here. He's the second highest in the Episcopalian Church, and he gave it to Mary to because his job was to spread acupuncture through the West. That was his intent through the religion to establish.
Wait, an Episcopalian minister.
Yeah, he was a high, you know, when I met him, I went knocking on his door because he actually lived around the corner from where I was and in England when I was studying with Van Buren and Worsley. Anyway, I went on and knocked on his door and, you know, and here comes this. Well, first his wife came in, went and got him. And here comes this guy. And the first thing I said to him was, do you know who Lama Govinda is? And he went, who? I say Lama Govinda, who was, you know, kind of a faraway teacher of mine, you know, that I was with a little bit. And he was, you know, a holy man from India. And I said to Lawson, you know, you have the same vibration as this guy. How come? And he said, well, you know, I'm the second highest in the Episcopalian church. So that was an interesting story. But anyway, so he had written several of the books, and you know, he was able to explain some of the history of the foundation in England to me, and in the English language, the creation of acupuncture happening in England, which was I forgot the guy's name. This getting old thing. Anyway, there were classes in France, and you know, Worsley went to him, Van Buren went to him, Lawson Woods went to him, the guy who was president of the association in London went to him. I forgot his name. Anyway, all these people went to this one class, which was, you know, kind of five element acupuncture. You know, it wasn't really, you know, Chinese TCM stuff. It was mostly five element, you know. And then, of course, you know, then they became the British Acupuncture Association, and then they had their internal fights with the name I can't remember, who was president of it, along with Worsley and Van Buren. And, you know, Lawson Woods just, you know, he had the directive to just bring acupuncture to the West. So you know, he wasn't involved in those personal fights, but that's kind of how there became a separation in that. Oh, yeah, also Felix Mann was there, too, in that workshop. That's why his book was written, you know, so kind of five element. You know, that's really one of the first books out, was Felix Mann. But it comes out of those workshops in France. I almost had it. La Pierre. Anyway. So those go back into the, mid-60s probably. Even early 60s, those classes. Uh-huh.
In France. So was this a tradition that came through Vietnam then?
Yeah, I'm thinking that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, yeah, because, you know, the French had a strong connection with Vietnam, I would say because of the wars, but, you know, because, it was a colony of France. And so I think that's why the tradition of the five elements came out more than any other, you know, TCM-ish kind of stuff. You know, it became more esoteric. I believe Worsley went off to study in, I forgot. I know Van Buren went somewhere in Asia, and Worsley went somewhere else, and kind of became a separation in styles. Anyway, yeah, back in the late 60s, I mean, mostly to me, I was a draft dodger. So that became kind of a big deal in my life, and it kind of threw me into the alternative world because, you know, you're either in it or you're not.
How were you dodging the draft?
Why?
No, not why. I understand why. How?
How? Well, you know, boy, I got every kind of deferment that you could get. And, you know, finally, when they did the lottery system, I just left the country and went to Australia because I'm also born in England. So I had British citizenship, and so I could go to Australia without a problem. And I went to literally the outback, figured they're never going to find me here, which was true. You know, I spent a year there, and then I thought, well, I should go back to America and really fight the draft. And I did. I came back. I snuck in through Canada. And interesting, I shipped a motorcycle over from West Australia that I had. And I'm driving across the border, and the border guard goes, "Where's that license plate, WA?" And I said, "Well, that's Washington, you fool. Don't you know what Washington is?" And the license plate was N for Northam, which is the town that I was in, and 13 for the 13th motorcycle in Northam. And the guy just waved me on. And so, you know, I kind of snuck back into America.
And that's how you got back to the U.S. from Canada. You rode a motorcycle with a license plate from Australia and said, "Well, this is Washington."
Yeah. West Australia, you know, WA. Which in those days, Washington license plate used to be WASH. So the guy just didn't know. I was lucky because, you know, basically the FBI was after me, which they were for the next year. And they finally caught up to me, and I went through induction, and I told them to go shove it, you know, where there's no light. By then I was old enough that I'm no fool. And they basically didn't want me. You know, I had an x-ray of my back. And I told the doctor there, I said, "Look, sir, when I go to Vietnam, my back is going to really hurt. And you, sir, are going to pay for the rest of your life my disability." And he gave me a 4F, which is unfit for military service, which I was very happy about. And so, anyway, so it left me with a bunch of alternative people, in a sense. And again, all the workshops in California, the Michael Tierra, Dr. Christopher, Dr. Jensen, you know, I would just study as much as I can with those people. At the same time, I was going to school, Cal Poly, to be a nutritionist, which I was. But at some point, California Dietetic Association, even though, like, you know, I was a straight A student, I was manager of the health center nutrition program. And when I went in to hear Frederick Stair, the head of Harvard Health Department, talk about the benefits of white sugar, they kicked me out of that because I was wearing sandals. And I thought, wow, you know, if you don't want to hear from me in what I was going to have as my debut, because some guy was lying about the benefit of white sugar, I don't want any part of Western medicine. So at that point, which was back in, 75, I think, I decided to do nothing but alternative medicine. And from that point on, that's been the case.
So that was a catalyzing moment for you.
It was. It was huge. It was a complete change about it. I thought I was going to be somebody special in the field of nutrition, which, you know, I kind of was. I was out there. I built a health food restaurant on campus, and I was director of this nutrition program that we had. And I was doing kind of, you know, some acupuncture, but, you know, not like a professional clinic per se, just treating people, because by that point, it was illegal, and you just treat your friends and things. And, California law hadn't established at that point. And so I left when I could have actually stayed and got a California license because, I'd been practicing for, 3 or 4 years at that point, but, not in a clinical situation as heavy as what later became, because I moved to Austin back then. And, there was no law either, but, I opened up a full-on clinic and, taught yoga, taught nutrition, taught new age medicine, holistic medicine. And that became really my livelihood. Although then the New England School opened up and I'd heard about that. And so I wanted to further my education. So I went to that. I met a friend of Ted Kapchak's in Austin, Fred, who was a monk who went to a fair that I put on. I put on a fair in celebration of Baba Hari Das, who was my yoga teacher. In light of his birthday, January 1, I put on a kind of healing festival, like what I used to go to in California.
You've been an organizer for a long time, haven't you?
Well, I like new inspirations. Yeah. It turned out, I opened up 5 schools. I like to start things. I'm not sure I'm the person to carry through with them, but, I definitely like the start thing.
Oh my goodness, for sure. Look, anyone who's really entrepreneurial, at least in my experience, they're great at getting things off the ground. They're great at seeing a need. They're fantastic at making something out of nothing. Do not ask them to maintain that thing. Don't add, it's like once it's created, not my job. I did my job. You're like a damn enzyme, right? You're like an enzyme. Totally. Put these things together, spark, I'm out of here.
That's pretty much how it was, get it going and limp it along through its original state and then pass it on to somebody else who would do the day-to-day work.
Yeah, because you're not going to do day-to-day work, are you?
No. Well, I'll do some.
No.
I'll do some, but, it's not it's not really worth sticking around. People have so much better qualities. Like, I sold my last school to an accountant who was the accountant originally with Dell and then with Whole Foods. And now she works for Apple and to a lawyer. And they basically have skills that I don't have. I'm pretty good at business. I'm pretty good at starting things like that. But they're the people that will carry it forward and stick to something. And
It's a different skill set for sure. Whole different skill set. So I just want to go back for a moment. This is, we hear so much about integrated medicine these days. And so many people are really keen on, we're going to integrate our Eastern medicine and Western medicine. Here you were at this conference. You were keen on integrating the holistic stuff. At least it sounds like it, that you were doing. You meet this cat from Harvard who tells us how great white sugar is, and they boot you out because you're wearing the wrong shoes.
Right.
And you're like, okay, I'm just all in on holistic medicine.
Yeah, pretty much. And integrative medicine is something that's so obvious. I have no idea why it's taken so long to, you know, not really be part. I mean, it's the person. You're treating the person, you know, and whatever works for the treatment and the health of the person is important, not whose ego is most efficient or effective. And, you know, I knew that very early on. And the other one thing I think is so critically important is that in our healthcare, what's most important is prevention, you know. So that's why the nutrition, that's why the yoga, that's why the Tai Chi, those are the things that are important for healthcare. And it is really maintaining and establishing health. And it's not, you know, and when things go south, you know, Western medicine's got some good toys. I mean, they, and the combination with acupuncture, Chinese medicine, and everything else, nutrition, herbs, blah, 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 all of that works to the benefit of the person. And, you know, acupuncture might not be primary in somebody's removal of the gallbladder, but it could prevent the removal of the gallbladder. It could help heal the gallbladder. It certainly is very good for post-surgical things. And so, you know, why not have integrated medicine? It just seems silly that it's never really made it to the level that it should. There is absolutely no reason why acupuncture isn't as part of a hospital as physiotherapy. I mean, I love physiotherapy too. And it's great, but you know, acupuncture should be a part of the hospital scene just like that, because it's good for as many things. And you know, it's not necessarily primary for everything, but nothing is. I mean, you can't do surgery for a cold. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's but acupuncture helps. You know, it's not, it's kind of slow for colds, but you know, it helps.
Well, it depends. If you catch that cold early on and you get the right treatment, you can just push that wind right away. Once you get the cold, it's a different issue.
It really is. But, you know, there's some basic concepts that, you know, like, you know, you shouldn't eat chicken, you shouldn't eat rice, you know, and have a cold. And those kind of simple things, which come out of Chinese medicine, you know, helps so you don't have the cold for a long period of time.
So you leave California, you go to Austin. I guess Austin's always been a little weird, hasn't it?
Yeah, I love Austin. It's been a long time going in and out there. It became my center, mm-hmm. really. I mean, between Santa Fe and Austin, you know, really where I consider home, although Austin's gotten to the point where it's so busy now, I don't go to it anymore.
Hello, everyone. Anne Cecil Sturman here. A working knowledge of the 8 extraordinary channels from the unbroken oral tradition of acupuncture is valuable beyond words. The power of these channels is tremendous if the practitioner has well-integrated diagnostic, theoretical, and practical skill. You'll be familiar with Dumai, the governor channel, or the Sea of Yang, the primal reservoir of Yang, which ultimately finances all movement and growth. But this channel also governs the ability to self-determine. The psycho-emotional presentation of your patients can be matched to a classical activation of this channel, clearing impedance in the free flow of Yang Qi to body, mind, and spirit. I'd like to share with you the marvelous potency of the Du channel in a full-length live treatment video from the seminar I taught last year in Melbourne, Australia. It's at annececilsturman.com/sinews2024. Click on the Jump to Free Teaching button or see the link on my Instagram page at annececilsturman. Thanks, Michael. Back to you.
So we're going to come back to Austin in a moment. From Austin, you went to New England School of Acupuncture. And what year is this? And who were you studying with there? Who was teaching at that point?
Well, I mean, I think it was 76. You know, Ted Kapchick was there. Andy Gamble, they were good friends. You know, they lived in the same apartment. And, you know, Andy, he came from China. And, you know, he's probably the most impressive translator I've ever known. But anyway, Andy and Ted lived in the same building. I used to hang out with them a lot. And Dr. So is the main teacher of the New England School at that point. And I used to kind of work in the clinic where Dr. So worked. I was the nutritionist. So I got to see a lot of exposure of some amazing treatments. I mean, Dr. So, you know, as hard of a practitioner as he is, he was a miracle practitioner. And, you know, people would roll in a wheelchair and walk out. Stuff you'd see that you just kind of couldn't believe. That was my exposure to that. And Banover was there. But mostly, you know, it was Ted's work. You know, he had a kind of a secondary school going on in the New England school. You could do his additional workshop, which I did. And those notes became pretty critical. And those notes went to England before I did, half a year ahead of me. And, you know, I went to the Van Buren School. Well, from New England school graduating there, I went to New York and I practiced in New York City for a while. And then I went to Van Buren's school. By the time I got there, that was where Peter Dedman was. Giovanni was there. Julian Scott. People you might know from books that were published. They were the teachers there, which was quite good. Unfortunately, they were using Ted Kapchick's notes, which, you know, I had just finished his program actually a couple times. So I kind of knew those too well. So I was a little bit bored. And, you know, in England, you're not allowed to practice until after you graduate. You're not allowed to stick a needle in somebody until after you graduate, which seemed to me a little dumb. And so me, having been in practice for about six, well, you know, treating people and doing things for about 6 or 8 years at that point, I taught all the people in the school there to needle each other. And so after about a year of Van Buren school, and they found out that I'd been encouraging people to treat each other because I thought, practice, 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 they kicked me out of school. You know, I never really graduated from there. So then I went to Worsley School, and I basically just challenged their exam because I knew the material pretty well. And, you know, I passed the exam, and then they wanted me to sit in England for 6 months watching somebody who just graduated. And I really couldn't do that. So between that and, you know, because I'd been in practice again 6 or 8 years, and they wanted me to sit with someone who just graduated.
Why didn't they invite you to teach a little something? I mean, look, at that time, there's not a lot of experience in the West, and you already have a little bit under
your
belt.
Yeah, well, you know, I never really went through the Worsley dogma, so they didn't want me. And Van Buren kicked me out because I believe that people should be sticking needles in each other from the first day of class, really, so that by the time you graduate, you have 2 or 3 years of experience treating. So, you know, I was kind of caught in between that, and then, you know, my Tai Chi teacher, who was actually pretty well known, Rose Lee, you know, she also kicked me out of class. So it was really interesting because Van Buren, who was a good friend of mine, really, he was, you know, he's a psychic. He's a real psychic. And I knew that. I could see that. So he gave me this thing where, you know, he lit the room with candles and, you know, just said, Stuart, you don't belong here. You got something else in life you need to go do. And so I did. And, you know, I had this inspiration to go to the desert and fast for 40 days. And I did.
You did? Which desert?
Well, Death Valley, actually. You know, I got a Volkswagen bus and I did kind of the Stanley Burroughs diet, you know, fasting diet, which is lemon, maple syrup, and cayenne. And I did that for 40 days, which just about killed me because at one point I got a scratch on my arm, and within actually about 8 hours, it went up all the way into my arm, a black streak. And so I actually drove to Las Vegas to get some herbs to treat that, which I did.
You had cellulitis.
Yeah, well, it's more than cellulitis. It's, you know, it's septicemia, really. So anyway, I drove to Las Vegas, and then I drove to, let's see, what was the name of it?
Oh, no, wait a minute. You went there to get herbs.
Yeah, which was crazy because I hadn't eaten for, you know, 28 or 38 days. And I'm driving in this big city trying to find an herb store to get some, not yellow dog. I did get my herbs, and I was able to, you know, doing those every hour, I was able to take out the toxemia, and I went to Jerome, Arizona, broke my fast in Jerome. And then I went to Santa Fe. Well, I'm going to back up just a little bit because before I did the fast, I was up in Victoria, British Columbia.
That's not the desert.
No, but
that's the opposite of a desert.
Right. Yeah, it was. Well, you know, actually, if you're close to the coast, which really I had a house that was a block away from the coast, it doesn't rain so much. And as you get a little further inland, it doubles every mile, actually. So anyway, I was there. And I started a school with Green, was the herbalist, Jim Green, and Constantine Darling was the martial artist. And I was the shiatsu person at that point. We, you know, acupuncture was kind of not really happening in Canada then. That would have been 79. And so we had this kind of collective school going for a while. And then I went to do my fast. I broke the fast. And then the next day I ended up in Santa Fe. And Santa Fe had a school there, the Santa Fe College of Natural Medicine. And so it so happened that the day I was there, one of the teachers was sick. And so I said, you know, I'll teach a class. And it just kind of blew him out of the water. And so they...
that was your job interview, huh? Let me teach a class.
pretty much, you know, and I was like so hyped up from not eating for 40 days that, you know, it's just like... And so... anyway, they invited me to come and open up an acupuncture school, which is what I really wanted to do. And so I did. You know, I went down to Austin. I finished my classes. I went back up to Canada, finished my part of the school, and then came down to Santa Fe and brought with me a bunch of students that were studying shiatsu with me then. And between the people who were already in Santa Fe and the people I brought from Canada, we had quite a school going already. So that was the first year, I think 79 or 80, somewhere in there. And, you know, I didn't really trust so much the guy that ran the school. Vivian and Sky. Anyway, they ended up like dying a few years later in a plane accident in Burma. But anyway, I didn't really quite trust him. I said, if I ever find you doing something dishonest, I'm going to move the school. I'm going to leave. And sure enough, a couple years later, you know, it was a subtle lie that he made. You know, I was just kind of burnt out on their relationship to the students. And so I asked Michael Moore, Mike, you know, my two best friends were Michael S. Moore, who is Michael S. Moore. He's a very famous herbalist. So anyway, Michael was my best friend. And then J. Michael Moore, the acupuncturist and martial artist, with my other best friend. So we all moved together and we started a new school. And then we brought in Dr. Ladd, who's the Ayurvedic teacher. So we got his green card for Dr. Ladd. And so we had a herbal program, Western herb program, my acupuncture program, Dr. Ladd's Ayurvedic. And then we had a massage program and a naturopathic program.
Just from the get-go. And is this still in Santa Fe?
Well, it was called the... Academy of Alternative Medicine or something like that. And it ended up, well, what happened was after I started the school, and it was pretty much me doing it, I went off to China for 3 months. And while I was away, they hired an administrator. And when I got back, the administrator and me just didn't see eye to eye. And they weren't very enthusiastic about supporting the acupuncture program, even though the acupuncture program was the biggest part of the school. So I then left the following year because it was a nonprofit school. And I left and I started a for-profit school, which is Southwest Acupuncture College, which actually just closed a few months ago. And that had been going on for about 40 years. So I started that. So the kind of the third school, you know, those the Santa Fe College of Natural Medicine. Then there was this Academy of Alternative Medicine. And then I started Southwest Acupuncture College. And then Dr. Ladd started his own school. And the school, which was the nonprofit, hired Michael Zhang, who later started the Institute of Traditional Medicine in Santa Fe. So it spun out a bunch of other schools because it fell apart after I left. but it had all these teachers, which, you know, thank God. I mean, Dr. Ladd's an incredible Ayurvedic teacher, and, you know, Michael Zeng, it was kind of a joke, but so be it. Because he was actually Chinese, and he was a Western doctor, but he wasn't the Chinese doctor of Chinese medicine. His wife was, but he was an appendectomy specialist, so he'd done like 5,000 appendix. But, you know, he had access to all my notes, and he liked my notes. Started the Institute of Traditional Medicine, and I started Southwest Acupuncture College, a for-profit school. He kept it as a non-profit school, and Southwest Acupuncture College, I kept around for until, I believe, 77. Yeah, 77. It must have been 87, 86, 87. And then I sold it for a dollar to Anthony Abate, who has been running it ever since. And I took off to go to India.
this is amazing. So what a crazy, vital, enlivened time it was there in Santa Fe. There's all this energy.
It was.
It's coming together. It's coming apart. It spins off new things. I mean, it's like the Big Bang. And and you're involved. You build some schools. You get some things going. And then you take off to India.
Yeah, well, you know, it's, you know, just kind of doing the Buddhist thing. You know, you got to go visit where Buddha was born, and Dharamsala, and, Buddha enlightenment, et cetera, et cetera. And then I came back, and, you know, I didn't really have a school. I actually started at that point. Actually, I started while I was, I would have started when I got back, what was called NAAAM, North America Advanced Acupuncture Medicine, which was a doctorate program. So I had a doctorate program back in about 89.
And this is after coming back from India.
And, you know, it was a good program, inexpensive. It had a lot of, you know, kind of self-taught. People would have to go to school and get credit for the workshops they did in the area in which they lived, and then come and give a thesis paper, and also have their clinic, which they submitted their clinical notes, and then I had me and other people would analyze their notes. And
kind of a mentorship type program, wasn't it?
It was very much a mentorship. It was very effective. It was very inexpensive, and it was licensed by the state of New Mexico.
How did that happen?
Well, New Mexico is kind of an interesting state. It's very small. You know, I was friends with the governor. I was friends with everybody, you know, because of actually Tom Duckworth and his teaching me how to, when I had Southwest Acupuncture College and the other schools, Santa Fe College of Natural Medicine, there was another school in town at the time run by
Kodadama, right?
Yeah. And, you know, they didn't really like me there. And they spent a lot of money and a lot of energy trying to get rid of me. And basically what it did is it taught me, you know, how to communicate with people. And so that's why he's my Upa guru, because he taught me how to really be functional. You know, I became friends with the governor. I became friends with the Department of Education. I got to meet all these people. And, you know, I ride motorcycles. So I just ride my motorcycle around town. Santa Fe is the capital. And so you meet all these people, and you meet them one-on-one in their office. And at that time, there was only a million people in the whole state. So you pretty much had easy access to everybody. And so I was able to convince them to have a doctorate degree. So they did. And so I had an early doctorate degree. It was about $1,500 to go to it. And you know, it has hence, you know, gone to court with the people who graduated from that and won, because it was basically validated by the state of New Mexico's Department of Education. So therefore, it was a legitimate doctorate program, which, again, leads into kind of why I ended up quitting the field, was the arguments over the doctorate degree in Chinese medicine, because I believe they were kind of screwing everybody, and everybody was wanting more and more money, and the students were being, you know, kind of just raped, in a sense, you know. It's and I didn't think you had to do that, because I'll go back a bit. So anyway, I had this doctorate program, and then later on, you know, I decided to go do clinic in Austin, and I bought my friend's clinic, John Scott.
John Scott of the Golden Flower Chinese Herbs fame.
Exactly. Yeah, I had a lot of connections with Golden Flower early on and things. So anyway, I moved down to Austin. I lived in the clinic garage. And people there wanted me to open up an acupuncture school. And of course, my karma is already an acupuncture school in Austin. So, you know, I did. I told the people that were there if they would help me, I would work to get that going, which I did, which is now the Academy of Oriental Medicine, which so that's my five schools. Maybe there's six because of the Shao Tzu school. But anyway, so I started the Academy of Oriental Medicine, and you know, Texas is a very different beast from New Mexico. I was so used to interfacing with politicians and just talking my way through life. But in Texas, everything is money, money, money. You know, unless you can put down a shitload of money, you can't really get anything done. So anyway, but those were the early years. And with the help of John Scott and other people, we were able to change the Texas law. And, you know, again, my help in New Mexico back in the early 80s. You know, we passed the New Mexico law, and I've tried to work with Arizona law and Louisiana law, and various things. But because of my familiarity with the, you know, being so easy in New Mexico to meet with these people, I just always thought it was that.
It's not. Texas is a whole different critter. it's a whole different.
So that Texas so this is money, money, money. Yeah.
This is interesting. You helped to get the law set up for acupuncturists in the state of Texas. Licensure?
Yeah, I was one of many. I mean, you know, I would say John Scott did most.
Takes a lot of people, I would think, in Texas.
There was a lot of people. I mean, the people from Houston. There was a big Chinese community in Houston that really put a lot of money into it. And, so it was really a collective. I was part of the collective in a sense. You know, at that point, I at least had a school, so you have some kind of authority. And you know, I know how to lobby, and I know how to, you know, go to the Capitol and be there. So, you know, I did some of that.
And you learned that through the difficult lessons that you had to learn in New Mexico that were frustrating and troublesome, and they helped create capacity, perhaps latent, that you would be able to use later.
Yeah, very much so. You know, also, I mean, just going back in time, I was kind of inspirational in co-starting the American, the AAA, American Acupuncture Association. I was kind of one of the co-founders. Actually, Duckworth would have been in that one too. And, you know, there was only a few schools. When I opened up the school in Santa Fe, I mean, there was only maybe four schools in the country. New England School, I thought, being the first, and a few other schools. I think by the time 80, 81 came along, I think ACTCM in San Francisco, I think the one in Baltimore,
that was a five element school, right?
Yeah, it was five element school. So, you know, I was kind of co-founder, starter of the AAA and also the Association of Schools.
Now, what was the purpose of these associations?
Well, you know, the membership association was an attempt to try to get more licensure in the States and get more awareness out in acupuncture. And then the Council of Schools was to strengthen our hold, you know, which the Council of Schools went on to form the accreditation and the NCCOM. So we formed the Accreditation Commission, and the testing body, the NCCOM, was all formed out of the earlier bodies, the AAAOM and the CCAOM. All during that time, I was the treasurer of those organizations for at least 10 years on each of those organizations. So I was kind of on the executive board for both of those organizations for like the first probably 10 or 12 years. In addition to, I've been the treasurer of the AOBTA, which is the American Organization for Bodywork Therapies of Asia. I've been the treasurer of that for 40 years.
That's a long stint. So these organizations, trying to understand this, they were formed, or they seemed to come together, as a way to create legitimacy for this burgeoning interest in Oriental medicine.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, because, you know, the only state, I think, well, there was maybe a few states, maybe Oregon, certainly California, had legalization by 81, I think probably back in the late 70s. So, you know, more and more we were trying to legalize it nationally. And so we really joined together to establish a profession. It really wasn't a profession at that point.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah. So it's, you know, we did that in light of trying to make it into something, which I think we did. You know, it's it is what it is today from the work that was done many, many years ago.
Well, you did. I'm appreciative of it because when I came along in the early, mid-90s, I already had a profession. I had a life. I was in my 30s. And, you know, I had a good life. I had a house, had a retirement program, you know, steady job, late model car. It was good. It was a nice middle class life. I liked it, right?
You ran into Chinese medicine and it ruined your life.
I ran into Chinese medicine and it helped my life.
Oh,
acupuncture
good.
was very helpful to me.
Good.
I got curious about it. But I just kind of kept it as a curiosity. Look, I had a nice job working in high tech. You know, I'm not going to screw that up. You know, the next thing, right? High tech was. But Chinese medicine, it just like was in the back. It kept hanging in the back of my mind, right? I read Ted Kapchick's book at the instigation of my acupuncturist. And I had no idea what the hell he was talking about in there. You know, that was just weird, right? It's all this Chinese medicine talk, wind and heat and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I've got no idea what they're talking about. I'm more confused now than I was before I started reading it, right?
Yeah.
But Chinese medicine kind of lingered in the back of my mind and it wouldn't go away. And at a certain point, I was thinking maybe I want to do a different career for like the later part of my life. I'm starting to hit a midlife crisis, right? And acupuncture was just knocking around in the back of my mind. And so I thought, maybe, but can I make a middle-class living doing it? Because if I can't, I'm not going to do it. And because there was licensure, and because there were schools, and because of all the groundwork that folks like you and, you know, people in your cohort laid down, I could go to a school. I could get a license. I could have a shot in making a middle-class living. And the way that I knew that was I interviewed some acupuncturists before I went to acupuncture school. I just opened up the yellow pages because we had those back then. And I called some acupuncturists at random. And the universe was kind enough to me to call some acupuncturists that were doing, you know, they were doing well in their life. And so I asked them about if they owned their own home and what, you know, what kind of car did they drive and how many hours a week did they work and what did they love about their work and what did they hate about it. And I wanted to see if this was something I might want to do. And the feedback I got back was, it's possible to have a nice middle-class living. Mm. Not guaranteed, but possible.
Not easy. Yeah,
right?
Not easy.
Well, yeah. Who cares about not easy? Look, if the beautiful thing about failure in any enterprise is it keeps you sharp. Mm. And it makes you put skin in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very special medicine. I mean, it involves a lifetime study. In that sense, it keeps your mind active and it keeps you in a life that's, you know, creative and fun. And there's no end to it. It just keeps going. So it's not like, you know, an insurance salesman. I mean, you kind of know the boundaries of that profession and there you are.
In recent years, the Siam acupuncture style has generated significant interest and a loyal and growing following. In the Siam approach, a precise diagnosis leads to a four-needle treatment to address the five element and six qi imbalances in the body. The four needles target the controlling and generating cycles. It's common using this method for the needle sensation to be stronger than in many other styles. Thus, the choice of needle becomes important. The Unico brand of needles lends itself to both strong and gentle techniques. These superior needles are made of uncoated Japanese surgical stainless steel and feature the best guide tube on the market with its unique beveled edge. Additionally, Unico needles have a tensile property that helps with freehanding needles into Jingwell points and allows you to more easily feel the arrival of qi. Blue Poppy is the exclusive importer and distributor of Unico needles. Use the code QI2024 to save 10% off Unico needles at www.bluepoppy.com. You'll be glad you did. Which might be fine for some people. You know, if you're, it's like, look, you're an entrepreneurial kind of character. So if there's something that hasn't been done and it looks like there's a potential, but there's also potential for failure, you're kind of enlivened by that. The people that you would hand it off to later on, the managers, they can't do the entrepreneurial thing. They couldn't do it with a gun to their head. But they're good at taking something that's already running. Those are the people that make good insurance salesmen, right? The people that can take a structure and keep the wheels on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's not the innovators. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about being a practitioner, in my opinion, one of the great joys I have from it is I never know what's going to happen when someone comes in the door. I don't know who they are.
Right.
I don't know what their resources are. I don't know what's going to help them. But that's not a bug, man. That's a feature.
Yeah.
Now we get to go explore together.
Yeah. And the depth of the medicine, it has so many avenues because it does involve, you know, physiotherapy. It does involve diet. It does involve herbs. It does involve acupuncture. It does involve manipulation. And the more you learn, the more you know, the more you're able to help somebody. And it just keeps growing and growing. And there is no end to that study. So, you know, if you have a mind that's creative and likes to have new things, I mean, there you are. You're never reaching end. You get better and better at what you do, but you're never going to reach an end.
Never reach an end. Yeah, that's the great feature about it. And it changes over time. So how would you say acupuncture has changed your life over the years?
Well, it became my life. And, you know, I think for many people, you know, Chinese medicine is something because of the depth of it. It changes who you are. You know, you look at life in a different way. You know, you bring in holism and, you know, depending again, the direction you want to take it. I mean, you know, for me also, you know, it involves meditation as part of that also. So it involves, you know, self-growth and self-awareness and things that make you a better person, I think, and makes you a more integrated, holistic person. I think all of those are really important. And you also then realize the importance of diet and exercise, and you start doing that in your life, because if you don't do that, you realize life is very short, you know. And if you want a longer life, you do what you learned, which is take care of yourself. And it is hard. It's a full-time maintenance thing, but it's something that you want to do. You know, even though it takes time, it gives you more life and life goes on longer. So in the long run, you actually have more time, even though you took time now to do those things. By not taking time, you have a shorter life. And I think the value of actually doing things which are necessary to make your life full now, you actually gain more time. So it's very beneficial. And I think, again, the holisticness of Chinese medicine in general just gives you a higher quality of awareness that never stops.
And it sounds like that's something that attracted you, that interest in awareness, that interested in introspection, looking inward,
Yeah. Putting
pieces together. That started you off as a young man.
Well, I think that's true of all the people that were involved in the early acupuncture thing. You know, when you look around the room, who was there? We were all there because most of us were like on some kind of spiritual quest. You know, we weren't there to make a living. We were there because we believed in the medicine and we believed in the life and we believed in the spirit. And, you know, it's kind of different that way now. You know, I think now it's much more, you know, money based. And, but I mean, you got to make a living for sure. But I think the people that really started this were all people that were on some kind of trip.
Well, it seems that way to me, which is why I'm interested in these sort of history conversations. Because, again, when I came along, I was looking for something that was established. I'd been a young man, and I'd certainly done my share of trying stuff on a whim just to see where it goes. And one of the things I realized was being able to make a little bit of cash and being able to support yourself, it's not unlike any other cultivation. It gives you a better life. You can live longer. You can live better. So I had to learn that money lesson some really hard ways. I was grateful when acupuncture came along and I saw I could make a decent middle class living. But you guys, I don't know if I would have had the courage. Certainly, maybe in my 20s I would have. But certainly in my 30s I would not have had the courage to go into something that promised me nothing but here's something interesting.
And, you know, just say, as we're kind of concluding, I think the main lesson of Chinese medicine, which can be taken into everything, is moderation, finding the middle path. You do need to make money. You know, you do generally have a family. You know, those things are important. And so you can't just, you know, meditate off your, you know, we're not a society that allows you to do that, really. And so, you know, the middle path of communication, the middle path of understanding, the middle path of working together, finding a way that, we can all be sensible about how to live together.
Amen to that. Man, and this, I was going to say, especially in this moment, but I don't think that's true. I think it's in any moment.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's always been that way. And I think that's one of the lessons of Chinese medicine in that sense is, how to find that in your life, how to find that in society, how to find that. So, you know, that there's never, you hear one side story and you can understand that. And you hear the other side story and you can understand that. Mm. But the reality is it's a middle path. You know, it's communication. It's middle ground. It's understanding. It's working together. You know, those are the things that are important. You know, it's you never in life get what you want, but you get what you need. In a sense.
to quote a famous philosopher.
You're right. That's right. And that age, it's showing your age, Stuart.
Yeah, well, but, you know, there's truth in that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a rock and roll song, but dang it, there's truth in that too, right? And it's that middle path.
It really is. It's the middle path, and you just got to work with it. You got to live with it, and you got to let it all go. You know, you got to let it go to enough that you can't resist that, fight it. I mean, you know, when you start resisting that, then you start getting the separations that we have today. You know, it's unfortunate, you know, but it is. You know, people want what they want, and that's my way or the highway, and life doesn't go on that way. You know, Chinese medicine really shows that.
You know, you were talking about some difficult teachers you've had. The, what'd you say, the Ufa guru?
Ufa guru, yeah.
The, the person that teaches you not through love and support, but teaches you through difficulty and adversity.
Yeah.
And I suspect we all have that. I suspect we all get that. We all have our teacher. The dark teacher. We don't really like them, but damn it, there's something to learn.
There they are.
There they are. And we got something to learn or they wouldn't be there.
That's right. Yeah.
That's my suspicion.
And, you know, life is meant for learning. I mean, you know, it depends with who you listen to and what you listen to. But basically, you know, if we're here for any purpose at all, it's to, you know, grow and experience and to, you know, be present.
Yeah. You've been at this game a long time, Stuart. Do you have any thoughts, advice, perspective for people who are just entering the profession, who are just at the beginning of their journey?
Wow. It's not an easy path. I mean, I don't necessarily even recommend it at this point because there's so many alternatives for, making life, making a living, those kind of practical things is much easier ways. But the reality is this Chinese medicine is so in-depth and it has so much to offer that you will always be entertained. But making a living at it is difficult. But, you have to have that self-entrepreneurship to be able to make that happen, make that work. And that's an important part of it. And if you don't have that, it's kind of difficult to do because it's not something that comes to you or not something that comes to your door knocking. It's something that you have to kind of make happen. Mm-hmm. But the path is worth it because there's so much there to be gained. But it's a struggle. I mean, there are such easier paths if that's what you want in life, you know, that are already pre-prescribed. You know, I can be a physiotherapist. I can be a Western doctor. You know, I know what that education is like. I know what I'm going to get. I know how much money I'm going to make later in life. Chinese medicine, you know, it's still an open door. It's still a path that's not really set in stone. It takes work. It's not established to the level that you want or that I would want. And it has a lot of barriers that are self-created barriers to some degree. You know, the schools themselves have made it difficult to actually make a living with it. You know, when you have a school that's $100,000 to go to, you have to be able to make that, to pay that back. And that's a tough road where you know that, you know, if you spend $100,000 being a chiropractor or a Western doctor, which, you know, that UNM here in Albuquerque, you know, it's cheaper to go to medical school than it is to go to acupuncture school. And
seriously? Really?
Yeah. I mean, up to recently, I haven't checked recently, but, you know, it was $17,000 a year to become a medical doctor here at UNM. And it's one of the better programs in the country because it's an experiential program. And you're guaranteed work here because we have so many poor people. You can just go out and, you know, they're pay for your school. So I always say to people, if you're really intelligent, you know, maybe you want to be a Western doctor first and then add the skills of other things. Because it's so hard to make enough money to cover the educational costs. And it's even made more compound by the doctor. When I was in the midst of working with a doctorate level, the schools were about $3,200, 3,200 hours. And I used to say, why don't you just add another 800 hours of clinic or a few hundred hours of, and then don't charge the $25,000, just add another $800 of clinic, which, you know, a school makes money by having a clinic. So it's like you make more money, you know, you don't need to make a private program for $25,000. And I just think it's very hard when you are competing to pay that much money for your education and then get out and have to make a living with it. Boy, you're in a hard press because it's not really accepted by Western society that much. As much as we've changed it and made it more and more so, and certainly its benefits for things like PTSD and things which are in Western medicine, something that really needs hands-on stuff and which is available, like, you know, through the Veterans Association and making changes that way. It's still hard to make a living in Chinese medicine, especially when we've just upped the antes on schools. And I realize that it's not easy to afford a school. I mean, it costs a lot of money to run a school.
Sure. And prices keep going up on everything over time.
It does.
You know, in some ways, when you began, there was no profession, but here's the thing, right? It's like, oh God, no profession. How am I going to make a living? But the cost of entry back then also commensurately lower.
It used to be $800 a year when I started the Santa Fe College of Natural Medicine for that.
Yeah. But then again, what kind of life might you have, right?
Yeah.
Well,
a happy life.
happy life. And again, look, there's a lot to be said for not having debt. Debt is a terrible taskmaster.
Yeah.
And if you got a debt to service, that makes things hard. You know, I went to school in the mid-90s and I managed to, even though my school frowned upon it, I still managed to work part-time and go to school at the same time. So I got out with zero debt and a lot of damn gray hair. I had left of.
What school did you go to?
I was at Seattle Institute of Oriental Medicine in the very early days before they were even accredited.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And Ben. So that was very, very early on. Yeah, Bensky and Karsten.
Yeah, great. Good.
Started that up in a little storefront. Oh, my God.
Exactly. Yeah. No, good teachers. That's good. That's very good.
Yeah, we had classes in the herb room. You know, I mean, there wasn't much there, but you know, I was lucky at that point when I came into it.
Good.
And you know, I suspect at this point, look, I live in St. Louis, Missouri. As one of my patients, an elderly patient I have, he was saying to me, he said, "Look, I've talked to a lot of people about acupuncture. Everybody knows about it, right? Here in the state, here in St. Louis, Missouri, this old guy that I'm treating, he says, everybody I know knows about it, and no one has anything bad to say about it.
Right.
So in terms of, is this medicine acceptable? Is this medicine getting into our culture and society? Dude, I live in St. Louis, Missouri.
Yeah.
And people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, a lot has happened over the years. I suspect the opportunities of this present moment, certainly different than the opportunities when you were younger, and I was younger for that matter. But, they're out there, and we know the incredible depth that Chinese medicine can take you to if you're willing to put time in the boat. You're not going to get it in the first 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take some time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of interesting, actually, how people get out of school and they don't really know the medicine. I mean, it's kind of bizarre. They take a weekend workshop and that becomes their practice after they spent 4 years.
Well, there's a lot of Western medicine that's being taught these days.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I don't know. I haven't been in school for a long time.
Uh-huh.
But yeah. It's just from what I hear of people that are in school, there's a ton of Western medicine that they have to learn, much more than you and I had to learn.
Uh-huh.
And that takes up some of the time. I don't know. Sometimes I think what we need is a 2-year acupuncture program where all you do is teach acupuncture, and then you set people out to continue their lifelong journey.
You know, that used to be the early days. That's pretty much what it was.
Yeah, we've really gone in a different direction with requiring more and more education, more and more standardization.
Mm-hmm.
That'll take you to a certain place. I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. You know, yin and yang are constantly, much to my surprise and often chagrin, transforming one into the other. Mm. It's not particularly comfortable, those transformation moments.
I would like to see the graduation be a little bit more time and a doctorate degree on graduation, which I think was a big mistake that we did in the early days to not do that. You know, it's like physiotherapists, basically now, you graduate physiotherapy school and you're a doctor of physiotherapy. And we should have done that to acupuncture. I think it would have made it a lot easier today as a profession in general.
Yeah, but the physiotherapists have been around a lot longer than acupuncturists. So, everything grows in its own way. And my deep appreciation to you and people like you that built something out of nothing.
Mm-hmm. Including Dan. Well, Dan was very instrumental with the relationship between, Andy Gamble and Ted Kapchick and all that back in the earlier days. Dan and Ted went to school together in Hong Kong.
Yeah, some of those early books became really instrumental. I still have my old Materia Medica that has Andrew Gamble's name on it.
Uh-huh, right. Yeah, Andy is a special character. He doesn't get enough credit. I mean, people don't know him as well as they should. But
is he still around?
I do believe he's living in Maui at this point, but yeah, I'm pretty sure that's where he is, either that or New Hampshire. He goes back and forth. But he is, to me, the best translator I've ever met. He is so, he can translate into 4 dialects as fast as you can talk English.
It's wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
So he's a real polyglot.
Yeah. Well, he grew up in China. So.
Oh, I did not know that. Well, that would help, wouldn't it?
Well, his father was a diplomat, a Chinese diplomat. So it's, it's kind of interesting what you're doing, learning the history of all these people on the back. It's very good. I think it's very important, very wise. I was trying to do that at one point myself. I tried to do a history group, and I filmed a bunch of people that were friends of mine. And so I have, maybe 8 or 9 hours, an hour each of various individuals in their history. And the other thing that I think I didn't mention, but I created was the National Teachers Association, which, I spent a lot of money to create that. And I just gave it to the association. I gave it to the Council of Schools, hoping that they would carry it on, which they never did, which is a shame because being a teacher of Chinese medicine is very different than being a practitioner. Mm. Being a teacher is a very specific skill that you, and so I was very wrapped up in teaching teachers. I thought that was a critical thing. And I wish that it would have gone on also. I think we would have a much more quality education had we put more emphasis on that. But we didn't. things change. You know, we have what we have. And
we do the best we can with what we got.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Stuart Watts, I so appreciate your time today and a look back at where we've been and where we are, and we can dream about where we're headed.
Well, thank you. It was more fun than I thought it would be.
All right. I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah. Well, you know, a little terrified moments when you don't know what you're coming into, but it worked out pretty well. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time. Sneaking back into the United States with Australian license plates, I suspect that is just the kind of grit you need to have in good measure if you're destined to start schools and help to build a profession that doesn't even exist yet. One of the ingredients that it seems Stuart brought to this endeavor was his keen focus on spiritual development. It seems to have given him a grounding to work through the challenges that went with the fisticuffs of politics and turf. I was especially appreciative of his thoughts on learning from what he calls the UFA guru, the person who seems like an obstruction, the one that is at every troublesome turn, the one who keeps smacking you from your blind spots. For sure, this kind of learning is a rough go, and ultimately, as you learn the lessons you need, it makes you better at what you're doing. I suspect that we all have UFA gurus, and it's easy to justify bad opinions about them. But if you take their painful teaching, it helps to crystallize your destiny. Thanks as always for listening. If you liked this conversation, if you learned something new, or found a moment of inspired insight, share the episode with your friends. If you want to support Geological, there's just one way to do that. It's by going to the website and becoming a member or leaving a one-time contribution today. Well, folks, that's it for today. Join us again next Tuesday for another conversation that connects up the voices of our community.